This new year, why not let Audible expand your life by listening? Explore over 1 million audiobooks, podcasts, and exclusive Audible originals that'll inspire and motivate you. Tap into your well-being with advice and insight from leading professionals and experts on better health, relationships, career, finance, investing, and more. Maybe you want to kick a bad habit or start a good one. If you're interested in learning how to master your emotions and hearing scientifically backed advice for using your emotions as a tool, may I suggest Shift by psychologist and bestseller author Dr. Ethan Cross? Trust me, listening on Audible can help you reach the goals you set for yourself. Start listening today when you sign up for a free 30-day trial at audible.com/Wondery. That's audible.com/Wondery.
A fog-laden Kingsbury run, in the air thick with mystery as the city of Cleveland sleeps unknowingly. It's here, in this shadowy gully, that a gruesome discovery was made. One that would start a series of horrifying finds. Welcome back, friend, to Hometown History. Today's episode takes us to the year 1934, when Cleveland was at the center of a series of brutal killings. And yet, the identity of the murderer remains cloaked in darkness, much like the night skies under which the bodies were found. This is the case of the Cleveland Torso Murderer, also known as the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run. As we discussed, this started in the year 1934, and until 1938, almost 5 years later, a dark shadow loomed over the Kingsbury Run area in Cleveland, Ohio. To set the scene, Kingsbury Run was a bleak and dangerous place at the time, heavily populated by the poor and characterized by harsh living conditions. It was called a hobo jungle because of its reputation as a haven for transients and those living on the margins of society during the 1930s. So this area was located near somewhat disreputable spots, some known for bars, gambling dens, and brothels, and all of that sounds like a serial killer's ideal hunting ground. And that's exactly what it became. The first discovery was made on September 5th, 1934, on the shores of Lake Erie, where a dismembered and decapitated body of an unidentified woman in her 30s was found. All that remained were parts of her torso and thighs. And to add to the grim details, her head was never recovered. The condition of her skin, red and leathery, suggested the use of a chemical preservative. As horrifying as the nature of this body was, Cleveland law enforcement was not ready for what this discovery was going to lead to. Even though there was a long cooling off period after this, another discovery was made a year later, on September 23, 1935. Near Kingsbury Run, at the base of a place named Jackass Hill, lay the body of a 28-year-old male. It was identified as Edward Androssi, a hospital orderly who was known to frequent the area's rougher regions. Androssi's body was found naked, completely drained of blood, and emasculated, with visible rope burns on his wrists. And this time, the cooling off period was not that long. Either he was getting bolder, or just more bloodthirsty. On the same day, a few yards away, police discovered another body. A decapitated and emasculated male around 40 years old, also preserved with chemicals. By this time, the police knew that these were not unrelated crimes, and that they had an active serial killer in Cleveland. Then around 4 months later, on January 26, 1936, another body was discovered. Florence Palolo, a part-time barmaid and sex worker, was the next victim. Her remains were grotesquely packaged in newspaper and placed inside half-bushel baskets, which were left behind in the Hart Manufacturing Building, a place too busy to be the scene of the murder. It was now becoming clear that the killer was growing bolder with each murder, and that was a cause of concern, adding to Cleveland police's troubles. Later on June 5, 1936, the severed head of an unidentified male was found wrapped in trousers in Kingsbury Run. The rest of his body was located nearby the following day, dumped rather audaciously in front of the Nickel Plate Railroad Police Building. Just a month later, on July 22, 1936, in a secluded area near Clinton Road, the decomposing body of a man around 40 years old was discovered. Apparently, he had been dead for 2 months already, and his body just lay there, waiting to be found and identified. Unfortunately, he became yet another John Doe. But there was something unusual about this murder. There was blood on the ground where it was discovered, something that was not consistent with the previous murders. The presence of blood indicated that this victim was killed right there, probably in a heated moment, instead of the pre-planned nature of the last few murders. More and more bodies were discovered in the months following, mostly left unidentified and in similar conditions. All of the bodies that were found shared several similarities, the kind that marked the killer's signature. All the victims were decapitated, and many were also dismembered, with their heads often not recovered. In several cases, the bodies had been treated with a chemical preservative that left the skin with a leathery and red appearance. The male victims were mostly emasculated, in addition to the other mutilations, which meant that there was an element of sexual motivation in these crimes. Adding to that, most of the bodies were found completely drained of blood. All of these consistencies across the cases indicated a kind of methodical approach by the killer, which meant he planned all of this and most likely was enjoying it in his own sick way. And that reflected in the number of victims. By May 1938, the official count reached 11 when parts of an unidentified woman were pulled from the Cuyahoga River. This was the first time traces of drugs were found in the victim's system. Was she sedated before the murder? Or had she already been a habitual user? Who knows? But now, with a count this high, panic was inevitable. Not just the number of murders, but the nature of these crimes. So motivated by seething hatred. It didn't help that the newspapers wouldn't stop fear-mongering, making Cleveland police's job even harder. They were already working at max capacity, with all of the police's focus being on this mad butcher. But even after months of investigation, there were no concrete leads to be followed. Detectives Peter Marillo and Martin Zaleski were deeply involved in the investigation and conducted extensive interviews, speaking with over 1,500 people in their efforts to identify the killer. It is even considered that Detective Marillo went undercover as a vagrant to help speed up the process of gathering information related to the murders. Even after that, there was no real progress being made. So in the hope of improving the quality of the investigation, Mayor Harold Burton invited Elliot Ness to serve as Cleveland's safety director.
If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment cause chaos. Use ShipStation instead. From running a business out of your garage to multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating tasks. Plus, you'll get the best shipping rates from global carriers. Calm the chaos with the shipping software that delivers. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.
Now, a little context as to why specifically Elliot Ness was invited in. Over time, Elliot Ness had built a strong reputation for his law enforcement career and accomplishments. He was best known for his leadership of the Untouchables, which was basically the team that helped bring down the gangster Al Capone in Chicago by aggressively targeting his illegal alcohol operations. Ness also had a history of fighting against corruption, taking on both the Mayfield Road mob and corrupt policemen, as well as tackling criminal activities in labor unions. So these achievements made him a prominent figure in law enforcement, leading Mayor Harold Burton to invite him in. Now, since he had such an excellent record, there was a great deal of pressure on him to identify the Cleveland Torso murderer as quickly as possible. As the investigation moved on, two main suspects emerged, each with intriguing connections to the case. The first suspect was Frank Dolezal, a 52-year-old bricklayer who had personal connections to several victims. Dolezal had lived with Florence Palillo, one of the identified victims, and was also acquainted with Edward Andrassy and Rose Wallace, both victims of the murderer. Considering the fact that he knew the few victims that the police were able to identify, he was arrested and interrogated. Crazy thing is, soon after his arrest, Dolezal confessed to the murders. But that was not it. He later recanted this statement, claiming that he had been coerced through physical violence. And apparently, his broken ribs while in custody were good enough evidence to prove that. So the circumstances of his confession made the whole investigation, in conclusion, useless. But it doesn't end there. He also committed suicide under dubious circumstances because he was found hanged in a way that seemed physically impossible given his height and the height of the hook from which he was hung. It's worth noting that he was in jail at the time, so maybe he really did hang himself. Or it was staged by the inmates or warden. The second suspect was Dr. Francis Sweeney. Now, he was a stronger suspect, and there was a number of factors that led to this. First and foremost, he was a doctor with the medical expertise that could explain the precise anatomical knowledge obvious in the dismemberments of the victims, which was one of the major parts of his modus operandi. Adding to that, Sweeney had several periods of erratic behavior and alcohol problems during his life, as detailed by his estranged family. So Ness secretly administered a polygraph test on him, using an early polygraph machine administered by its inventor. Now, Sweeney reportedly failed this test, which was yet another thing that pointed toward him. But despite these circumstances, Ness could not move forward with charges due to the lack of concrete evidence, and maybe due to political pressures as well, since Sweeney was related to a local congressman. So the link of these murders to him could never be definitely proven in court, and that meant the police were back to square one. The police were clearly struggling. As you could guess, identifying the killer was not that easy of a task, and apparently the killer wanted Ness to know that. On August 16, 1938, soon after Ness joined the investigation, the final known victims, victims 12th and 13th, were found within view of Elliot Ness's office. a rather grim taunt from the killer to the inability of police to arrest him. And this taunt was enough to push Ness a little over the edge. Ness organized a massive raid on Kingsbury Run's hobo jungle, where many transients lived, the type of people that became victims at the hands of this killer. So it was considered somewhat of a dramatic move. In the early hours, accompanied by a team of 35 detectives and police officers, Ness led a sweep of the area, detaining 63 men. But he did not stop there. He also ordered the shanty towns, which were the makeshift homes of many homeless people, to be burned to the ground. This decision was heavily criticized because it was seen as a desperate measure to smoke the killer out of their hiding place. But the collateral damage was far too much. The objective was reasonable, but the way he was trying to achieve that objective was too extreme. But here's the thing. It seemed to have worked. After the raid, the torso murders actually stopped. Now, it is still unclear whether Ness's raid was the reason that no more victims were found, or if there was some other factor at play. Some people still believe the killer was Dr. Sweeney, because the time these murders stopped also coincided with the time when he voluntarily admitted himself to a mental institution. But then again, this was never proven. Whatever the reason, this marked the end of the brutal series of crimes that had haunted Cleveland for almost 5 years. And while there was some peace now for the people of Cleveland, the mystery of the identity of the killer still taunted the detectives. Maybe we just aren't meant to know. And that's all for today. The horror of the torso murders leaves us with many, many questions, but the reality is we're far beyond ever finding an answer. It is just another reminder of the depths of human depravity and the limits of justice. Thanks for listening to Hometown History, and be sure to follow along for more interesting stories from the past.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.